Acorns are dropping off my Chinese house. Two ducks in my spyglass, fiery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Welcome to Yarns at Yin Hu, a podcast about the fiber arts and other post-apocalyptic skills. Episode 133, Morels and Magic Cork Shrooms, Wednesday, August 31st, 2016. I'm your host, Sarah. You can find me on social media as Sarah Pomegranate. The Yarns at Yin Hu podcast has a Facebook page, and it's available on iTunes. Today's episode features the following segments: The Back Porch, The Front Porch, Off the Shelf, Ever Expanding Skill Set, and Yarn Lover at Large. Since my last recording, the weather has turned much cooler and breezier and more pleasant. There's just a hint of autumn in the air. And that may be partly due to my imagination, because I took a very, very brief trip to Vermont this past week. And in central Vermont, in the mountainous area around Killington, where my sister's farmstead is, you can tell that the season has definitely begun turning toward fall. And they are beginning to do a lot of harvesting from their gardens up there. So maybe I just brought that feeling back to Pennsylvania with me when I came, but I just feel like the breezes in the air and the cooler temperatures at night and in the morning put me in mind of autumn. Since I've been doing a bit of traveling, I haven't had too much time for knitting, but I did complete a sheep to shawl project using yarn that I have processed myself. I've spun and plied, and in some cases I've used botanical dyes to dye the yarn, and in some cases I'm using the yarn in its natural colors. I began working on one of the sheep to shawl projects because I actually need to do two. No one's going to boot me out of the class or anything, but I do feel responsible for producing two projects this year because I ripped out my 2015 project after realizing that it wasn't something that I was going to use or wear, and that I really wanted to put that yarn to its best effect. So now I have several different batches of yarn in many different colors. The weights are reasonably similar. They range from like a heavy fingering weight to a light worsted weight. There are different yardage amounts, different colors, some of which go together and some which I feel do not. And the whole thing was just starting to become incredibly challenging and to feel overwhelming to me. So I set aside some yarn. It's mostly from my 2016 course. And I worked to create a version of a new design that I've been working on. The new design is for a cowl in fingering weight yarn of six different colors. The sheep to shawl project that I completed is knit in sport weight yarn, and I think it has five different colors. I was working on a larger size needle and with different quantities of yarn. So it really is inspired by, it's a version of the letterpress cowl that is forthcoming in mid-September. But I'm very pleased with the result. And what was most interesting was to use the yarn that I hand blended before I spun with some black alpaca and some very dark brown Jacob wool. And this came out to a beautiful sport weight yarn that's very, very dark in color. It isn't black, but it's a very deep brown. And against that deep brown, some of my hand-dyed yarns, I feel they really shine and it looks very pretty. So I used some gray Jacob that has not been dyed. And then I used some Jacob yarn that I dyed in madder, in marigold, and cochineal. And the cochineal dyed yarn is actually from my 2015 sheep to shawl class. So there's some merging of yarns created in different years has begun. Now I have the task of looking at all of the remaining yarn, and I would still like to do some additional dyeing of yarn and creating a project that incorporates everything I have left. Some of the yarn colors don't work together very well, and so I may over dye things with a walnut dye, or I may just work on some of the colors that don't seem to blend in and see if I can just target those and work on achieving something a little bit different. I really like the highlighter yellow color that is achieved from dyeing yarn, very pale or white yarn with weld. It's a brilliant, brilliant yellow, but it's a yellow that doesn't work with the other more muted colors that I've achieved. So I thought that maybe I would take some of that yellow yarn, and when I harvest my indigo, which should be around the end of September, it's already started to flower a little bit. So now I'm at the stage where I'm pinching off the flower heads so that the leaves keep growing larger. But I'm thinking that when I harvest that indigo and I use it to make a dye, that I might over dye some of that yellow yarn and see if I can get a shade of green. That's something that I haven't tried to do with my botanical dyeing so far. And I'm thinking that maybe a green would work itself into a bigger garment more readily than this bright, bright yellow. My original intention in 2015 for my sheep to shawl course was to create a poncho. And I did that, but unsuccessfully. I just wasn't pleased with the final result. So I'm still committed to using the rest of the yarn that I have to create a kind of technicolor poncho that just runs from one shade to another in hopefully a pleasing array of colors, and that has a little more integrity in terms of its shape and is definitely something that I want to wear and use all of the time. A few more words about the letterpress cowl that I mentioned. This pattern is forthcoming in mid-September. It was inspired by a Hankett set that was dyed by Megan Lacey. She has the Distel Fink Fiber Company, and I met her and her mom at a small yarn and fiber festival in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, early this spring. I saw this Hankett set. I am usually not someone that's very interested in mini skeins or anything like that, but I saw this and then I continued to walk around the festival, and the colors in this set just had captured my imagination. So I went back to purchase it, and then it sat around in my stash for a while as I kept searching Ravelry to find a pattern that I could use. And I just couldn't find anything, but the more I thought about it, the more I wanted to knit with this beautiful yarn. So I took that Hankett set with me, and not anything else except for a sock project and a little bit of spindling with me when I went to Provincetown for a week vacation. And I thought that if I were committed to working with this yarn and coming up with a project that would really do justice to the beautiful colors of this Henkett set, then maybe I could come up with a design. And so I just kept working at it. I kept knitting and unknitting and writing everything down and came up with something that is very pleasing to me and I think might be a great option for folks who have mini skein sets or who want to use up small portions of leftover sock yarn or yarn from shawl projects and things like that. The pattern calls for 6 skeins of approximately 80 yards each, and it's knit on a US size 4 needle. It's a cowl with a cabled neckline, and it includes a few intermediate techniques. I would say this is not a beginner pattern. It's great for someone who wants to extend their skills and wants to try something a little bit more intricate. So there is cabling, there is a Kitchener stitch close, there's picking up stitches and short row shaping, as well as working with different colors for the color changes. If you're interested in seeing some sneak peeks, you can search hashtag letterpresscowl on Instagram. I've been reposting some of the photos from the lovely test knitters who are working on this project, and I will also post some photographs of my sample knit of this shawl. If you plan to attend Knitter's Day Out in Somerdale, Pennsylvania, you can see the sample that I knit in Megan Lacey's beautiful yarn in the Distel Fink Fiber Company booth. Megan will be selling additional letterpress Henkett sets, and she will be selling some kits as well. And I will have additional information about that in a future episode. The front porch. Just about the time when I'm going to experience a decrease in the amount of time I have available for crafting, I got the notion that it would be a good idea to undertake a big project in preparation for Rhinebeck 2016. For a long time, I have wanted to knit the Bressay dress by Gudrun Johnson. This is a Fair Isle yoke dress pattern, and it's a lot of yarn, but I think it's not a very challenging project in terms of technique, and it's a great way for someone not very experienced in Fair Isle to practice Fair Isle because there are no floats or carrying of the yarn because the pattern details are quite small and you're only ever holding 2 different colors of yarn in your hands at the same time. It's a dress, but it's a short sleeve or cap sleeve dress, so you don't have to worry about a great deal of sleeve knitting. And I think because it's for cooler weather, it's something that you can knit rather short at a tunic length and then wear thick tights or leggings underneath. I had the curiosity to see whether or not I could find enough yarn in stash to knit this dress. And so I pulled out a whole bunch of things. And over the past few days, I've been swatching. And by swatching, I mean starting the dress pattern and trying out different colors, different yarn weights, and different needle sizes. The majority of the yarn that I have for this project is sport weight. And the pattern calls for fingering weight yarn. So I dropped down a needle size to US size 3. And I am currently knitting the smallest size of this dress because I'm quite a loose knitter. Once the yoke is complete, you can do increases and decreases for the shaping of the dress as you see fit. And the beautiful thing about this is that you can keep trying it on to see how it's going. It has a little more Fair Isle detail at the hem of the dress. And then there are these really darling pockets which look so stunning, and I think they'll be easy to knit, but maybe not very easy to attach successfully to the dress. So I think the sizing, the shaping, and these pockets will be the challenges for this dress. But a lot of knitters remarked that once they got going, they were surprised to see how quickly they made progress on their projects. So that's upcoming. And then I've been thinking a little bit about holiday knitting. One of the things I have been doing for quite a few years now is knitting or crocheting a very small ornament and sending it to family and friends in lieu of some sort of store-bought present or a commercially produced Christmas card. And it seems to go over well. The recipients have really been enjoying them, and I have enjoyed the challenge of finding something new and different to do each year. Since I've been doing quite a bit of meditative spindling, I've accumulated many, many little mini skeins of hand-spun yarn in various colors, weights, fibers, things like that. And I do not see that a sock yarn blanket or any kind of blanket project is in my future, so I have been wondering about what to do with all of these small bits of yarn. Occasionally I make a toy, and I have knit some birds of happiness. These little amounts of yarn are great for that project. But I started thinking about whether I could use some of this hand spun for Christmas knitting, because that would make it doubly special to make something and to make it with my own yarn. So I thought about acorns, and I had looked up an acorn pattern for an ornament, and that looked pretty nice. And I was wondering if that could be done in crazy colors or if I would need to go with traditional browns. And then Samuel and I began to play a two-player strategy card game called Morels. I was interested after Joanna Spring talked about attending Gen Con and some new games that she purchased. I messaged her and was asking her advice about, you know, what would be a good starting point for a two-person game for people who have never done that kind of thing before. And she gave me a few suggestions, and a game called Morels was one of them. I read a lot of reviews, and I decided to give that game a chance. So I purchased a copy, and Samuel and I have played this game several times since it arrived. I'm very impressed at the playability of the game and the variety of different kinds of games we've played with the same rules and the same cards. So it's not the kind of game where you kind of come up with the strategy and then you figure out how to play the game the same way each time. There is different strategy required, and the chance and sequence aspects of the game make it a different game every time. So it's really kept our interest, but it's not so challenging that you can't have drinks and a conversation while you're playing it. The other thing that I really enjoy about the game is the aesthetics of the playing cards. There are really beautiful and sort of enchanting depictions of mushrooms in the day, and then even more mysterious ones of the night cards at night. And I enjoy just looking at these drawings and the coloration on these cards while we're playing. So it occurred to me that maybe there was a little knit mushroom pattern that I could try for holiday gift giving. So I did a search, and I found the pattern Magic Corkshrooms by Julie Tarsha. This pattern is made by a publication that I had already used for little cork trees that I gave a few years ago, and was great fun to knit, excellent photo tutorial, very clear directions, and uses just a bit of yarn. So I tried out the pattern with some of my hand spun, and I am sold. These little mushrooms are remarkably mushroom-like. There's a twisted rib detail to create the sort of gills underneath the mushroom, and then you can switch colors or not, but then there's shaping and a little bit of cabling at the top of the mushroom, and they fit over a cork, which we happen to have in great supply at Yinhu. So I think because I want to use these as an ornament that I will go to the hardware store and see if I can find any teacup hooks or little eye hooks that I can screw into the cork, and then I can attach a piece of yarn to hang the ornament from the cork, and that will be stable. And then the knitted mushroom cap can just sort of sit over top of the cork. I think these will look very good in rather outlandish colors. Maybe I can give some of the more traditional folks traditional mushrooms and some of the younger, more adventurous types outlandish mushrooms, and everyone will be happy this holiday season with mushrooms hanging on their Christmas tree. Off the shelf. August is concluding, and so is the Eat Your Words read-along that has been running all season long. It's been great to share titles and to hear about some of the things that Yarns at Yinhu listeners have been reading all season long. I was asked last evening about intentions for the podcast, and one of the things that has been first and foremost in my mind as I've been recording this podcast over 3 years is to really give listeners something to think about and to urge them toward something that they wouldn't necessarily come up with sitting on the couch knitting by themselves. I feel like it's a responsibility I have as a podcaster to try to light a spark, to try to urge you to consider something maybe you haven't thought of before. And sometimes that means urging people toward a place of moderate discomfort. That's certainly what happened with my reading this summer. I selected Coming Home to Eat, The Pleasures and Politics of Local Food by Gary Paul Nabon. And at times, I really didn't like the book. And at times, I really didn't like myself because I felt that the author was, you know, taking this high road to local food and local eating. And I just started thinking about the things in my pantry and in my refrigerator and how I measured up to that. And there really was a sense of friction and discomfort. And what I've tried to do in this year of balance, instead of rejecting that feeling, is to embrace it and to really just try to feel comfortable in that and to think about it and to think about what small change I would like to make to take a step in the direction that I want to go. So my hope for listeners who took part in this Eat Your Words read-along is that maybe you had an experience of something similar, or at least that you were urged to consider something you hadn't done before. I thought I would share, in closure of this Eat Your Words read-along, the epilogue of Coming Home to Eat. Yes, I lost 8 pounds or more during the walk, and the walk he's referring to is a kind of food pilgrimage that he takes with a group of people at the end of the book. And as expected, my HDL-LDL ratio improved, confirming that all of those fiber-rich native foods probably do have the health benefits that our clinical studies suggested earlier. But walking has its benefits too, and foraging, and praying, and singing, and laughing, and community building. If the native foods are worth eating only for their value in reducing blood sugar and cholesterol levels, we might as well just extract their soluble, fiber-making genes and insert them into some easy-to-grow, easy-to-prepare, nutraceutical packaged food. But they are also good for the land and good for our souls. I have come to love their flavors, even though friends still remind me that some are acquired tastes. I don't doubt that they are right, since I still serve meals at my table that my friends and family don't have the guts to eat. But their acceptability to consumers is not really what is keeping them from being more widely embraced and adopted. The real bottleneck in the revival of native, locally grown foods is a cultural, or more precisely, a spiritual dilemma. If we no longer believe that the earth is sacred, or that we are blessed by the bounty around us, or that we have a caretaking responsibility given to us by the Creator, Yahweh, Earthmaker, Gaia, Tata Dios, Cave Bear, Raven, or whatever you call him or her, then it does not really matter to most folks how much ecological and cultural damage is done by the way we eat. It does not matter whether we ever participate in the butchering of our meat, the harvesting and grinding of our grain, the foraging and drying of our herbs. Until we stop craving to be somewhere else and someone else other than the animals whose very cells are constituted from the place on earth we love the most, then there is little reason to care about the fate of native foods, family farms, or healthy landscapes and communities. I continue on, adding to my dooryard garden, harvesting what I can from the wild lands around my home, raising minor breeds of turkeys, and planting native seeds. The percentage of food that I get from local sources will no doubt vary over time, but I'm sure it will never return to the abysmally low proportion it was before I began my modest experiment. I cannot go back to ignoring where I am situated in the food chain, that cascade of energy that can be shunted in the direction of regeneration or in the other direction, toward Desolation Row. Whenever I have doubts about whether all this effort has been worth it, I go out to the wilds beyond my backyard and taste a fruit or flower freshly plucked from a tree or vine. My mouth, my tongue, and my heart remind me what my mind too often forgets. I love the flavor of where I live and all the plants and creatures I live with. Thank you to everyone who has participated in the Eat Your Words read-along this season. The final prize for this read-along is the $25 gift certificate to the Woolly Thistle. It's been generously donated by Claire of New Hampshire Knits Podcast, and who is the proprietor of the Woolly Thistle shop online. The random number generator selected post number 154, Salmon Knits. So Jenny, please get in contact with me and I will set you up with Claire of New Hampshire Knits so you can claim your prize. Perhaps someone is interested in obtaining my copy of Coming Home to Eat. This is a paperback version of the book I've been reading all summer. And I know I haven't been overwhelming in my praise, but maybe you are interested in reading it or you know someone who would really enjoy it. Please leave a post in the thread for this episode, episode 133, and I will message the first person to claim it, get your mailing information, and send it out to you. All of my reading about native plants and eating locally reminded me that I haven't really done very much canning on my own recently. In my very tiny kitchen, I am quite selective about canning projects, and my preference is usually to go to my mom's house and help her with canning in her much larger and better equipped kitchen, and two people always make quicker work. Earlier this summer, I did go help her. We did 3 different batches of sweet and sour pickles, some of which were designated as my pickles, and I brought that home to put in my pantry this past weekend. And I had started thinking about maybe doing some canning of my own. So I brought some tomatoes from my sister's homestead in Vermont, and I brought some more tomatoes home from my mom's New Jersey garden. And I decided that it would be kind of a soulful canning project to make one thing out of those merged tomato harvests and to can it, to keep some for myself and to have others to give away. Since I don't have a big canner, it's easiest for me to can in half pint jars, and that's also a great size for gift giving. I was able to make enough salsa for 14 half pint sized jars and 2 pint sized jars. And the whole enterprise went remarkably well. I thought very carefully and came up with a system for the process before I began. And I usually begin by cleaning up and organizing my kitchen before I start, really making sure that every available space of countertop is clear. I have all of my materials pulled out, so I'm not searching for them while I'm trying to do the canning. And then, of course, I consulted my mother for some advice along the way. One thing I've had a problem with recently is jars breaking during the canning process. That could be because I've reused my jars many times, and some of them are hand-me-down jars, so they do weaken over time. But also, I feel that it has to do with putting jars directly on the bottom of a pot. Because I don't have a canner, the jars just sit on the pot bottom, and that tends to be extremely hot. It's not buffered by a canning rack, and I think that's what can cause breakage. That also, for those, some of you still remember and feel sorry for me when my indigo jar broke when I was trying to create an indigo dye last year, and that was a half gallon size jar that broke, but I had it sitting on the bottom of the pot. My mom found this kind of interesting little device. I think it's called a daisy canner or something. It's not a rack that will lift out of the pot, but it is a rack that sits in the bottom of the pot and keeps your jars elevated so they're not sitting directly on the surface of your pot. And there are two sides. One is suitable for larger jars and the other is suitable for small jars. And I could fit 7 jars in my largest stock pot. And they were raised from the bottom, they were covered with water, and then I have a nice fitting lid for that pot. So it was the perfect water bath for canning. So that was a great strategy. And then the other thing I did was that I just had extremely clean jars, and then I put them in the water bath for a few minutes, then empty them out before filling them. Because sometimes in a small kitchen, what can happen while I'm completing steps is that something cools down. Either the salsa that I'm canning cools down, or the jars cool down, or the canner cools down, and everything needs to be the same consistent hot temperature to avoid breakage. The final tip that my mom gave me, and she said she's been reading a lot about canning, and there's a kind of a revision of traditional rules for canning. Some people are even arguing that you don't necessarily need to sterilize the jars because when they're in the water bath full of food, they're sterilizing. That's kind of an extreme view, but she's been reading about this kind of thing. And she advised me that once the salsa sat in the water bath for the required 30 minutes, that I should turn off the heat, remove the lid, and let the jars sit in the water bath for 5 minutes before removing them from the pot. She said this gradual temperature change would prevent breakage, because sometimes I have had jars break in the pot, and sometimes I've had jars break on the countertop when I remove them from the water bath. I had no jar breakage during this canning, and with 14 half pints and 2 whole pints, I think that's a really great yield of salsa for gift giving and for snacking at our house. Yarn lover at large. Yesterday, I was very fortunate to be welcomed by the New York Knit Nerds, who had arranged a meetup because Jenny of the Handmade and Woolen podcast she's in town in New York this week for her work after having relocated to Vermont. And there were several members of the group who were all getting together in Chelsea for coffee. Since I had the afternoon without any particular plans, and since this is always the time where I want to pack some more fun in before the summer's over, I decided to venture into the city. It wasn't particularly hot, so that was great, and it was a really nice New York City day. I traveled to Pearl Soho, where I got to chat with Allison and to find out that she was getting off earlier in the evening so she could join the Knit Nerds for the meetup. I made a purchase of some watercolor linen, which is newly stocked at Pearl Soho. This is made in Belgium, and I bought 2 yards of the mountain purple color. It looks more like silk than like linen in some regards, because it has a subtle sheen to it. There's a lot of depth of color. It's a little bit brown, a little bit lavender, a little bit pink. It's a really mesmerizing color. I'm not certain what I'm going to sew with this fabric. The staple dress has been on my mind a lot, so that's a possibility because it will be very versatile through the fall and then again in the spring. But I've been thinking about what I might sew with that beautiful and very special fabric. It was a small group, but a cozy one, and we transitioned from Pushcart Coffee over to Co. for some really fabulous garden fresh pizza and really agreeable and interesting conversation. So I'd like to shout out hello to Marie, Allison, Jenny, and Jenny. And hopefully we will meet again for some fiber-related event in the future. September, they were telling me, is devoted to the fiber arts in many ways in New York City. So it could be worth checking out some of the venues that you typically frequent to see if there's something special and fiber related during the month of September. Allison mentioned that they might have window knitting at Pearl Soho, and there are other things going on around town. So you should check it out.
Acorns are dropping off my Jenny's house. 2 ducks in my spyglass, fiery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Leaves her down like a lady, waiting for a naked man. River bends like an elbow, turning stones to sand. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. sycamore trees are blazing like a rainbow fire. Just like Linda Curtis, burn out on a wire. It's a subway nature thing. It's a subway nature thing. It's a
Thanks for listening. If you've enjoyed today's episode, I hope you will consider joining the Yarns at Yinhu group on Ravelry, leaving a star rating or a review on iTunes, or following me on social media. Music for today's episode is Sweet, music and lyrics by Samuel St. Thomas, performed by Krista Long and Cesar Diaz. Eat well and stay strong as you hone your post-apocalyptic skill set this week.
Nature's ever get you high, till your face is smile. Jump a river naked, hike a country mile. It's a subway nature thing. It's a subway nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.